Yeah, it's my pleasure to welcome Alexander Smith from St. Anselm College and Dartmouth as well to our seminar in the first of the year. So Alex has done a lot of work on the Paige Wouters formalism, and he's going to talk about his perspective on it and his new results. So it's up to you now.
Thank you very much. And thanks for inviting me to speak here. So I'm excited to share some results with you. This is work that I've done in collaboration with Mehdi Ahmadi at the University of Santa Clara, Shadi Ali Ahmad, who's at Dartmouth College, Thomas Galley, who I'm sure you all know, and I see in the audience there, Philip Huhn at the Okinawa Institute of Technology, Max Locke at the University of Vienna, and Andrea Russo, he's a PhD student at the University College London. So like the title says, what I want to talk to you today about is the Paige and Wouters formalism. And what I'd like to do is introduce it maybe in a more modern way, and then sort of reflect on what are some of the interesting results that have come out, and then share some of the work that I've been doing. So just by way of motivation, I think I'm preaching to the choir here when I say that quantum gravity requires a new dynamical paradigm, right? So when we think of classical theories or even our standard quantum mechanical theories, the idea is usually we have matter or fields, and we're interested in their dynamics relative to some fixed background space-time structure, right? But when we look at general relativity, we know the situation's quite different, right? There, we know that matter interacts with space-time. And so when we construct our theories, we can't use space-time as some background static structure to define our notion of dynamics. And in fact, when we go to something like quantum gravity, the goal there is really to quantize both your matter degrees of freedom and your space-time degrees of freedom on the same footing. And so we would like a theory maybe that's agnostic about how it treats matter and space-time, or treats it in the same way. And then from which, after quantization, we might emerge some notion of dynamics. So what happens when we try to quantize gravity? Well, how might we go about doing that? We should choose some phase space that we want to quantize. And one way to formulate general relativity is in terms of the three metric associated with a particular three geometry. So you can think of this three metric is like the configuration variable in your phase space, and it has a conjugate momentum p, right? And so this is a picture from S.A. Wheeler wrote, and he's saying, well, let's think of the phase space. He calls it superspace, and each point in this corresponds to a different three geometry, right? And then we would cast GR in a canonical form, and what we find is that the Hamiltonian of the theory looks something like this. So here, we have the Hamiltonian. This first term is quadratic in the momenta, so we can think of it as a kinematical term. There's a potential here that depends on the three metric. And then if there's some matter degrees of freedom, this rho is representing the stress energy, and it would couple to the gravitational degrees of freedom. And we find that the Hamiltonian is in fact constrained to vanish here. So if this is our theory, how would we go about quantizing it? Well, the first thing, we might adopt as the Dirac quantization procedure. So the first thing is to say that our physical states of the theory, that is those that are allowed, are going to be annihilated by the constraint, right? So this is how we go about implementing the constraint in the quantum theory. And then if we have some dynamics, right, our Hamiltonian ought to generate some flow with respect to time, some time parameters. So maybe we postulate the Schrodinger equation. But because our physical states of our theory are annihilated by the Hamiltonian, actually this state here that's describing our geometry and our matter actually doesn't flow in time. It's frozen. And so the question, you know, it was, I guess, one thing is you might think this is a little weird at first, but I mean, what's the lesson of general relativity is that there is no preferred background time. So the Hamiltonian of the theory did, in fact, generate some evolution that would single out a preferred time variable. But nonetheless, we're left with this problem that the state psi here is frozen. It doesn't appear to evolve. And so we have to reconcile this fact with the time evolution we see around us. And that's what the Page and Wooters formalism does, is it tells a story about how to go from a constrained system like GR into one where we can recover an internal relational dynamics between the degrees of freedom described by psi. So with that as motivation, the first thing I want to talk to you about is a quantum description of clocks. And here, what I want to introduce is a notion of a time observable as a covariant positive operator valued measure. So I'll introduce that theory. And then the second thing I want to do, and I'll spend most of the talk on this, is discussing the Page and Wooters formalism. So I'll use this description of clocks to formulate the Page Wooters formalism, and I will discuss in particular some of the criticisms that were raised against the approach in its infancy, and how those are overcome, and some of the questions that people are thinking about today. And then I'll share some results on a gauge invariant reference frame dependent notion of subsystems that came out of thinking about these constrained systems. And finally, I'll outline a way in which this Page-Wooters formalism can be extended to a field theoretic setting. So the first thing is I want to talk about is an operation notion of time. So this is from an essay Einstein wrote in 1949, saying time is considered measurable by a clock of negligible spatial extent. The time of an event taking place at a point is then defined as the time shown on the clock simultaneous with the event. So this is Percy Bridgman, who's writing in 1927, reacting to Einstein's relativistic revolution. He says, Einstein, in seizing on the act of the observer as the essence of the situation, is actually adopting a new point of view as to what the concepts of physics should be, namely the operational view. In general, we mean by any concept nothing more than a set of operations. The concept is synonymous with the corresponding set of operations. So what he's saying here is, you know, what allowed Einstein to go forward here was this operational notion of time that he adopted in terms of what's shown by a clock. Now, I'm smart enough to know that depending who you hang out with, operationalism can be a good word or a bad word. I would like to say we could probably all agree that it's a useful way to start thinking about theories and interrogating physics and to come up with reasonable definitions. So with that as motivation, I want to talk a little bit about how we can use a quantum system to measure time. So what is a clock? I want to first start by answering this question. And for me, what I'm going to take to be a clock is defined by this quadruple. So it's a physical system, so it has to be described by some Hilbert space. There's a Hamiltonian, right, that generates some evolution. There's a fiducial state that we might initialize the clock to. And we have a time observable that we want to measure on our clock that'll read out the proper time that's elapsed. So I want to talk about this a little bit more and how to, in particular, construct this time observable. So if we're just thinking in ordinary quantum mechanics, we might have our initial state of our clock here, rho c. And what happens is the time parameter tau, the elapsed time, gets unitarily encoded into this state rho c by the evolution generated by the clock Hamiltonian. So that some later time, the clock is in the state rho c of tau. And so then the question is, if we want to use this system as a clock, we better be able to construct a time observable that's able to estimate this parameter tau given the state rho c of tau. So what should we demand of a time observable? Well, it should satisfy the following properties. Namely, on average, our time observable should estimate the elapsed time tau, right? And second is that the variance in the measurement of TC of our time observable should be independent of the elapsed time we're trying to estimate. These seem like reasonable properties of the time observable. So I want to talk a little bit about how now we'd actually go about constructing this time observable. So the first thing is we're going to appeal to a more general notion of observable than that described by a self-adjoint operator. So I'm going to take our time observable to be a positive operator value measure. And what is a POVM? Well, it's a map from a set. In this case, this is the set of measurement outcomes of our clock. So the different values tau that the clock can read. And with each measurement outcome, we associate an effect operator. In this case, I'm going to take it to be a one-dimensional projector here, tau. right? And I'm going to call these clocks, I'm going to call these states tau. These are going to be clock states, and they're going to correspond to the clock reading the value tau. So now, what are the properties of these effect operators? Well, they basically have to be positive, and they have to add up in a nice way and be normalized so that you get a well-defined probability distribution. So namely, you can use these effect operators with the Born rule and ask, you know, what's the probability of the clock reading tau? Now, so far I've just really described a general positive operator value measure, but what makes this a time observable is how these clock states are chosen. And those properties on the previous two slides, namely that you want your observable to on average estimate the correct time, these are satisfied if TC is a covariant with respect to the group generated by the clock Hamiltonian. So what do I mean by this? Is basically that these clock states here that form these effect operators are all connected to one another by the unitary generated by the clock Hamiltonian. There's a very rich theory on these covariant POVMs and plays an important role in quantum metrology. But this is here what I mean by a covariant time observable, is in a POVM defined by these effect operators here that satisfy this condition. And sometimes these are known as coherent states associated with the group G. So, okay, so let's give a few examples. The first case we might consider is an ideal clock. So we might consider a particle on the real line. There, the Hilbert space of our clock would just be L2 of R. And we could take the clock Hamiltonian to be just the momentum operator. So in this case, this Hamiltonian, what is it going to do? It's going to generate translations of our particle along the real line. And so we can consider our clock states basically to be like position eigenstates, right? So we know that the momentum operator generates translations in space. And so these will act as our clock states. And we could form a POVM in terms of these clock states. But in this case, you know, we can do a little better and actually construct a self-adjoint operator associated with this time observable, namely just the regular position operator here. But what's powerful about these covariant time observables is you can look at more general settings. For example, we could take the clock Hilbert space here to be a qubit, right? And we could consider the Hamiltonian to be proportional to the Pauli Z operator. And then we could take our clock states to lie on the equator here of the Bloch sphere. And in that case, our clock states, tau here I'm writing, these are just the states along the equator of the Bloch sphere, we could form a covariant POVM associated, but there wouldn't be a self-adjoint operator here. So this leads to a more general notion of an observable that allows us to associate time observables with more general systems other than ones just sort of described by this ideal clock Hamiltonian here. Okay, so that's what I mean by a quantum clock. And what I want to do now is use that formalism to introduce the Page and Wouters formalism. And so like I alluded to in the introduction here, the big idea is that we're going to start with some physical state that satisfies some constraint, just like in GR. And the idea is we want to recover the state here is going to describe both the system and the clock. And we want to recover some internal relational evolution of this system relative to the clock. And so there's a couple ways to go about doing this. And the Page and Wouters formalism is one of them. And I want to just share now an excerpt from a lecture that Feynman gave at Cornell in the 1950s, arguing that we should have a plurality of different formulations of the same physics. So I just want to share that excerpt with you now. So I just want to make sure that everyone can hear it. So maybe, Felipe, if you can give me a thumbs up, if you can hear.
Now, another thing that people often say is that for guessing, two theories here, suppose you have two theories, A and B, which look completely different psychologically, have different ideas in them and so on, but that all the consequences that are computed, all the consequences that are computed are exactly the same. Maybe say they even agree with experiments, they add to them. The point is, though, that the two theories, although they sound different at the beginning, have all consequences the same. It's easy usually to prove that mathematically by doing a little mathematics ahead of time to show that the logic from this one and this one will always give corresponding consequences. Suppose we have two such theories. How are we going to decide which one is right? No way, not by science. because they both agree with experiment to the same extent, there's no way to distinguish one from the other. So the two theories, although they may have deeply different ideas behind them, may be mathematically identical, and they usually, people say then in science one should pay, one doesn't know how to distinguish them, and that's right. However, for psychological reasons, in order to get new theories, these two things are very far from equivalent, because one gives a man different ideas than the other. By putting the theory in a certain kind of framework, you get an idea what to change, which would be something, for instance, in theory A that talks about something that you say, I'll change that idea in here. But to find out what the corresponding thing is you're going to change in here may be very complicated. It may not be a simple idea. In other words, a simple change here makes maybe a very different theory than a simple change there. In other words, although they're identical before they're changed, there are certain ways of changing one which look natural, which don't look natural in the other. And therefore, psychologically, we must keep all the theories in our head. And every theoretical physicist that's any good knows 6 or 7 different theoretical representations for exactly the same physics, and knows that they're all equivalent, and that nobody is ever going to be able to decide which one is right at that level, but he keeps them in his head hoping that they'll give him different ideas for guessing.
So I think that's a very nice clip. I think one thing Feynman's asking us is we should know 6 or 7 different theoretical representations for all of the physics we know. That's a big ask, I know, for me. But I think more importantly, what he's arguing here is, why it's useful to have different formulations of the same theoretical concepts. His name, it gives us different ideas for ways in which the theory might change. And this is really what I see as one of the main values of studying this page from Wouter's family. So with that as motivation, let me begin by thinking about this theory. Let's suppose we have some theory here, where we just have some system that's evolving with respect to some external background time, right? If we wanted to carry out some analysis of this system, we might write down an action, and we could vary this action, and at the end of the day, we'd get Hamilton's equations of motion, and we could solve them. We could instead consider another theory, and we're going to formulate this theory on an extended phase space that includes both a description of the system and the clock whose dynamics we're going to use to track the system. So we could again write down some action here for our theory, where this is now an integral over some arbitrary parameter, tau. And this Lagrangian L here now depends both on the coordinates of the clock and on the system. And if we were to choose this Lagrangian L in such a way that it's in terms of this original Lagrangian LS over here in theory one times T dot, we can show that it's exactly equivalent to this original action S over here, right? So it describes the same theory, but the Lagrangian here, this big L here, is different, right? And so when we carry out the Hamiltonian analysis and you ask, well, what's the Hamiltonian associated with this Lagrangian instead of just LS, we actually get a Hamiltonian constraint. We find that the momentum of the clock here plus the original system Hamiltonian is constrained to vanish. So we get a constraint just like the constraint we get in GR. And so the question is, we know how to quantize this system and get, say, the Schrodinger equation, but maybe we should try to quantize a system in terms of the Hamiltonian constraint and ask, how can we recover a notion of dynamics from that? So that's where the Page-Wouters formalism picks up. So again, we have some constraint in our classical theory here. When we build our quantum theory, we want to promote these to an operator and demand that the physical states of our theory, this capital psi, are annihilated by this constraint. So then you can ask, well, is this the most general constraint possible? And the answer is no. Here we have the clock's momentum operator. In general, maybe it could be some arbitrary clock Hamiltonian. We could get a Hamiltonian constraint that looks something like this. And even more generally, we might imagine that there's some interaction coupling the clock and the system. So for example, if we look at the constraint, the Hamiltonian constraint of GR, right, we see that if our clock degrees of freedom are going to be made of some matter, right, well, they're going to couple to the gravitational degrees of freedom. So maybe we should consider some clock system interaction. The most general constraint we could look at looks something like this. However, for the rest of this talk, I'm just going to ignore the possibility of interactions and just focus on simpler Hamiltonian constraints that look something like this here in this first generalization. Okay, so with that as background, we're ready to state what the Page-Wooters formalism is we suppose that we have some constraint that looks like this, or we have our clock Hamiltonian and our system Hamiltonian, and our physical states here are annihilated by the constraint. I've told you about a covariant time observable described by these one-dimensional projectors that are defined in terms of these clock states, which are covariant with respect to the clock Hamiltonian. And now let's suppose we have some system observable described by these effect operators here with outcomes A, right? Well, what the big insight of Page and Wooters was to say that, well, dynamics ought to arise from conditional probabilities of the sort. What's the probability of getting outcome A when the clock leaves the time T? And so they wrote down this expression here for this conditional probability, right? This is what we might expect. This is like a joint probability of the clock leaving T and getting outcome A. And this is like the probability of the clock leaving T. And it turns out that this actually equals the standard probability that one would expect in an orthodox formulation of quantum theory, provided that we identify this psi s of t as this conditional state here, where we take the physical state of our system and look at the overlap with the clock being in the state t here. So this conditional probability can be computed right from this physical state, but also we can define this conditional state that behaves very much like the standard time-dependent wave function in orthodox formulations of quantum mechanics. And in fact, it even satisfies the Schrodinger equation like we expect. So this is how we go from this constrained theory that doesn't have any a priori notion of time to one where we cover a relational evolution between the system and clock. So you may be asking, okay, well, why formulate quantum theory this way? Well, I think one of the big things is that that we can recover just the dynamics. We can recover the dynamics from the theory from just the Born rule in this conditional probability here, right? So it's not like we had to postulate some unitary evolution. We could just postulate the Born rule, and provided we ask questions about the right type of time observable, we get out a notion of unitary dynamics. And I believe this was one of the main motivations for Don Page and Bill Wooters. This is Bill Wooters writing in an article following the initial publication. He says, one motivation for considering such a condensation of history, and by condensation of history means this physical state here, is the desire for the economy as regards to the number of basic elements of the theory. Quantum correlations are an integral part of quantum theory already, so one is not adding a new element to the theory, and yet an old element, time, is being eliminated, becoming a secondary, even approximate concept. So this, the correlations that are in this physical state that are leading to this dynamics, provided we define the right time observable. So, okay, so this is great. Now you might wonder what happened. Well, pretty soon after, in the late 80s, this proposal of Page and Wooters was pretty heavily criticized by Kukash. And what did Kukash say? Well, this was his criticism. This is taken from, so the saying is, you know, I gave some reasons for formulating this, but then after it was, this proposal was put forward, it received some pretty serious criticism by Kukash. And so I'm taking this here from a discussion that happened at a NATO conference. I'll give the citation in a couple of slides. But what he says is to Don Page at the end of his talk, he says, you never apply the conditional probability formula to answering the fundamental dynamical question of the internal Schrodinger interpretation. Namely, if one finds the particle at A at the time T1, what is the probability of finding it at B at the time T2? By your formula, that conditional probability differs from zero only if T1 is equal to T2 and the overlap of A and B is not equal to zero. So what he's saying here is that if we have some system or a state of our system, we make some measurement of A at time T1, then we're gonna associate this with the effect operator, the clock reading time T1, and getting outcome A, right? And then it's going to evolve some time. And then we make another measurement at time T2 and get outcome B. And so we would associate that with an effect operator here of the clock moving time T and getting outcome B here. And so what Kukash is saying is that if we, you know, really you're asking about these one-time probabilities, what's the probability of the system doing something at some time T? But really what the actual dynamical question that you should be asking is, what's the probability of B when T2 conditioned on some earlier time when A was, when the system had outcome A at the time T1? What he says is when you go and compute these two-time probabilities in terms of these effect operators here, maybe you can see what happens is you're going to start to get overlaps of these clock states. And if those are orthogonal, like for position eigenstates, say, like we were talking about for our ideal clock, you're going to get a delta function that pops out. And in particular, you get the wrong answer for what the propagator should be, namely the overlap of A acted on by this unitary, and then finally with the final state B, modulus squared. So he's saying that, you know, this is nice, but really the fundamental dynamical question is we have some in state, maybe in some out state, and we should be looking at these two-time conditional probabilities, right? So, okay, so,
Alex,
this leads him to conclude, right? In brief, your interpretation prohibits the time to flow and the system to move. For me, this virtually amounts to a reducto ad absurdum. Yeah. He basically says, because you get the wrong propagator and something proportional to that delta function, this basically disqualifies this conditional probability proposal. But Don fired back and he says that only quantities at a single instant of time are directly accessible, and so one cannot directly test the two-time probability you discuss. One could instead at one time test the conditional probability that the particle is at B, given that the time is T2, and that at this time there is a record indicating that the particle was at A at the time T1. And so then Kukash comes back with this quick remark. He says, Don, you're the first person I met who simultaneously believes in the existence of many worlds and is a solipsist of an instant. And then Don goes back on to say, well, you know, I believe in memories, and you know, we only make measurements at a single instant. So this is what's operationally accessible here. So who's right? What I'll show is really you can resolve Kukash's criticism either along the lines of Kukash in terms of genuine two-time probabilities, or you can formulate things in terms of memories and resolve the problem along the lines that Don had imagined here. So after these criticisms, what happened to the Page and Reuters formalism? Well, here is the original publication down here in 83, and then not much happened. And this is where Kukash's criticisms of the approach were raised, right? And he wrote this pretty seminal review talking about time and interpretations in quantum gravity. How's the audio, by the way? Is it still laggy? Is it bearable? Or
I think it's okay. Yeah, okay. We're good.
Okay, great. So so he raised these criticisms of the approach here. And, you know, being a real authority in the field, one might say that this really discouraged a lot of people from working on that proposal. And it wasn't until 2004 that a paper appeared on the archive by Dolby that started to address this criticism. And then another group, Gambini, Porto, and Pullin, modified the proposal slightly and also started to address this criticism. But I would say that the first paper to really address the criticism head on without modifying the proposal was this paper in 2015 of Giovannetti, Lloyd, and McCone. And they put forward a resolution that was very much in the spirit of what Don had imagined in terms of having memories and storing measurement outcomes in these memories. But I think what more importantly this paper did was, is it recast the whole formulation in a language that made it accessible to those in the quantum information community. And so I would say really this paper is responsible for this huge spike of interest in the Page Reuters formalism, because now we had a whole other community that was able to start thinking about these problems and bringing the tools and questions that they're familiar with. And then we proposed an alternative resolution that was more along the lines of KuCash in this paper here with Philip and Max last year. So that's what I want to tell you a little bit about now. And to do that, that's going to require me to tell you a little bit about these things called partial and complete relational observables and show an equivalence to another, yet another formulation of describing relational dynamics in constrained systems. So, right, when we have some particle, maybe it's going along some trajectory, usually what we do is we write some equations of motion that allow us to evolve. Maybe we're interested in the height of the object as a function of time that allow us to evolve the height observable in time. But really, what is dynamics about? Ultimately, it's about correlations between some clock and the height of the object here. So we could say everything we wanted to about the dynamics just by talking about correlations between what I'm calling now partial observable T associated with the clock and a partial observable F, in this case, measuring the height of the ball. And so the idea is that we don't ever actually measure one of these partial observables individually, right? But instead, we always measure them together. We always measure the height at or when the clock is reading a particular time. So these two partial observables together form a complete or a relational observable that encode correlations between these two partial observables. So the idea is that what we want to do is construct a complete relational observable that I'm going to denote by this capital F here that corresponds to the state of the system S when the clock reads a particular time tau. So this will be the observable associated with a particular reading of the clock tau. So I want to talk about how we might go about constructing such an observable that acts on these physical states here that are annihilated by the constraint. So the first thing we might do just at the classical level is if we start off with our observable T, right? What we can do is this map here I'm calling alpha is the flow generated by the constraint. And so for constraint theories, we know that for gauge theories, that this constraint here generates a gauge evolution. And what we can do is then solve this. So what this is doing is this alpha here is evolving this observable T along the flow generated by the constraint here by an amount S. And then we can solve this equation for the S or the gauge parameter such that when we evolve T by that much, it's equal to the parameter tau. And then what we can do is we can then evolve our observable we're interested in, maybe the height of the system, this F here, by the same amount S. And what we're left with is this relational observable that has the interpretation of the height of the system when the clock reads the time tau. And in this paper here by Bianca Diedrich, she goes through this in detail and provides a series expansion for such relational observables here. And it's defined, I mean, the important thing is this series expansion here, and it's defined in terms of the nested Poisson bracket of the Hamiltonian constraint and the partial observable F here that we're interested in. So, okay, that might be a bit technical, but what we did was we took this form of the observables and we quantized them using those covariant POVMs I told you about. So each term here, instead of substituting in a self-adjoint time operator here, we replaced it with the nth moment of the covariant POVM. And so when you do that, and obviously you replace the nested Poisson bracket, the nested commutator, and you get an I out. But then what you can show is that actually this observable here is equal to the so-called G twirl over this initial effect operator associated with the clock state, tensored with the observable F, the partial observable F we were interested in. So where this G twirl here is given by this group average, so this is an average now over the group generated by the Hamiltonian constraint. So this was, when I saw this, this was quite exciting because it connects with a lot of other work that's been done on quantum reference frames, namely this big review here by Bartlett, Rudolf, and Speckens, where this G-twirl is featured very prominently and used to remove background information about the system. So we have this construction of these relational Dirac observables that we associate with this, you know, the system taking value A when the clock reads a time T. And what we can do then is show that those one-time probabilities that Don Page was advocating for, they can be written in terms of expectation values of these relational Dirac observables. And in fact, this shows the equivalence with the Page-Wooters formalism, that we can use instead these relational Dirac observables to recover these conditional probabilities, shows the equivalence of the Page and Wooters formalism with this other formulation in terms of observables of this form here. But what we can do now with these relational Dirac observables is we can now properly compute that two-time probability that Kukash was interested in, namely the probability of B when T2 given A when T1. So just using the standard formula for multi-time probabilities, we get something like this that works out to be the correct two-time probability. So then in this way, we could, by showing this equivalence of the Page-Wooters with these relational Dirac observables, we were able to overcome Kukash's criticism. I just briefly want to mention the proposal that Giovannetti, Lloyd, and McComb put forward, because it also recovers the correct propagator. So again, here's Don Page arguing in another paper here, says, here I simply wish to argue that all the testable predictions of ordinary quantum mechanics appear to arise from one-time conditional probability. So, you know, maybe Don Page wouldn't accept the proposal that we put forward, but another way to go around that is to actually introduce a memory register into your Hamiltonian constraint and describe sort of a von Neumann measurement that's happening at time T1 and time T2, and then look at just one instant of time after this final von Neumann measurement of B of these memory registers here. And so we can compute that probability and write this in terms of the probability of A and B at time T2 and divided by the probability of B at time T2. And in this way, you also recover the same propagator, or the correct probability, two-time probability. So the moral here is that I think Kukash raised an important criticism, and we learned a lot about the formalism by trying to answer it. And we can answer it by introducing additional ancillas that count as memory systems and recover this two-time probability. We write it as a one-time probability. Or we can use these relational Dirac observables and construct a genuine two-time probability in terms of them and get the right answer. So this is the way to overcome these criticisms. So I just want to briefly comment on where we are now. And any list is obviously biased. So I think reflecting on what Feynman said there, you know, what is the value of a new formulation of relational dynamics is that it allows us to ask what more general dynamics are possible or what things we can change. And so I've just listed some themes that have been explored. One big thing is what happens if we don't use ideal clocks, or if we have some epistemic uncertainty associated with measuring our clock, we can show, or it's been shown, that this leads to a fundamental decoherence mechanism. We can ask what happens if the clock and system are allowed to interact with one another. And this leads to a particular modification to the Schrodinger equation. We can ask, what does dynamics look like to a clock that's temporally delocalized? There's been some results in that direction. The whole formalism, we've been talking a lot about clocks, but it can be generalized to arbitrary reference frames, or more general, I shouldn't say arbitrary, but more general choices of reference frames. And then there's some others who have started to look at how we might get a notion of causal structure coming out of these constrained dynamics in the Page-Wooters formulas. So I think that's one sort of big question to be explored. Another, it has to do with generalizing the procedure into relativistic scenarios. So one thing you can do is conditional probabilities are really nice if you want to compare the readings of two clocks in a time dilation scenario. So that's one thing you can do is construct this probabilistic notion of time dilation between quantum clocks. Relativistic systems are often characterized by Hamiltonian constraints that are quadratic in the momentum. So one thing we looked at in this paper here was how to generalize the approach to Hamiltonian constraints that are quadratic in momentum. And then if I have time, I realize I'm getting near the end, I'll mention how we might generalize this approach to field theory. I think the other really exciting thing is this notion of quantum reference frame transformations. So there was this paper here by Giacomini, Castro-Ruz, and Bruckner talking about how we might actually change between quantum systems that are used as reference frames. And it was later realized that these reference frame changes can then be embedded in this Page and Wouters formalism, so that if you wanted to change between different descriptions from different clocks, it's actually the exact same frame transformation that appear. So I think that's really exciting because, you know, we have these different formulations of these frame transformations and they're all converging on the same sort of results. And finally, showing the equivalence of the Page-Wouters formalism with other approaches to relational dynamics is also something that's popped out. Namely, I've discussed this equivalence with relational Dirac observables, but there's yet another formulation known as this quantum symmetry reduction that turns out also to be equivalent with the Page and Wouters formalism, as well as different integral representations of the of Dirac observables have now been discussed in terms of these conditional probabilities. So I think there's a lot to explore here, and I've just sort of tried to collect some recent results that I think are interesting. So I realize I got about 10 minutes left. So in the 10 minutes, I'd like to describe some recent work on how we might get a physical notion of subsystem and entanglement. And so to motivate that, I want to talk a little bit about the steps involved in the Dirac quantization procedure. So we might start with a classical system, and let's suppose it has three different systems, A, B, and C. And we would start with our classical phase space, might just be the direct product of all of the phase spaces of these individual systems, A, B, and C here. So that's what I'm denoting by gamma A, gamma B, and C. So just the Qs and Ps of each of them. And then when we go to quantize that theory, what do? We put hats on our Qs and Ps, and we get what's called the kinematical Hilbert space. And what happens is, this kinematical Hilbert space actually inherits a tensor product structure from this original phase space. But then the next step is to construct what's known as the physical Hilbert space. And this is where we impose the constraints. So the physical Hilbert space is defined as all of those states that are annihilated by the constraint, right? And so a priori, it's not clear if this physical Hilbert space inherits any sort of tensor product structure or notion of subsystem. So, you know, you might think of something like if you have a qubit or two qubits, right? The Hilbert space there would be C4. And there's, you know, as you know, it could partition into C2, tensored C2 there. But then if our constraint was something like, you know, we wanted to restrict to the anti-symmetric subspace, that would be just a one-dimensional subspace. And that would no longer carry the same sort of tensor product structure. So when we restrict to this subspace here, or this physical Hilbert space, it's not clear what notion of subsystem or tensor product is available to us. And I just want to maybe make a slight technical remark is that it's, you know, constructing this physical Hilbert space is in general quite difficult. It might not just be a subspace of the kinematical Hilbert space. You might have to introduce a new inner product on the solution space of this equation here and complete that space to form the physical Hilbert space. So it's not at all clear that whether or not this tensor product structure that we originally sort of encoded our notion of distinct subsystems is inherited by the physical Hilbert space. So this was the big question we asked is how can we construct a physical notion of subsystems on the physical Hilbert space? And to do that, I want to talk about just entanglement a little bit. So I know it's nearing the end of the talk, so maybe I can just check if everyone's still awake by asking you all this question. So is this state entangled here? So how many people want to maybe put up their hand or try and answer the question? Is this state entangled?
Is it a trick question?
You can't see me smiling, so I'm smiling on camera, so you know it's a trick question. So maybe I'll pick on you and you can answer that. Yes, it is entangled.
Sorry?
Maybe I can pick on you and say, and you can answer.
Okay. Well, yeah, I would say, well, it's entangled across the tensor product decomposition implied by your writing.
Okay. Okay. So you're being very smart, and I see Robert gave me a thumbs up. Maybe I'll leave my video on if it's not lagging. Is that? Yeah. Okay. All right. So. Yeah, that's exactly the point, is that entanglement is always defined relative to a partition of a Hilbert space. So we might have two observers here who are able to make measurements of a certain set of observables, right? So maybe we have our system and we localize it spatially so that all of these operations that Daphne is able to perform are localized to some region. So we might write those as observables that look like this. And similarly, you might have Shaggy over here who's able to measure local observables over here on B. And it might look something like this. With respect to these observables, we would say that this state is entangled, right? You know, from any unitaries generated from these observables from a separable state, we can't get to this entangled state here. But we might imagine some other observer, Scooby here, that for whatever reason can only measure observables or has access to observables that look something like this. These are obviously non-local relative to this partition. And it turns out that relative to this set of observables, the state isn't entangled, right? So the whole notion here is that, well, first off, entanglement is relative to a partitioning of the Hilbert space. And that partitioning of the Hilbert space is induced operationally by the observables that agents have to access or can manipulate. And so different restrictions to distinguished sets of observables will introduce different partitions of the Hilbert space. So in a little bit more detail, what's going on is that we could consider some system here. And maybe it's described by this Hilbert space H and the complete set of observables. It might be the bounded observables on that Hilbert space. And let's suppose that this algebra of observables partitions into a collection of independently accessible and mutually commuting associative subalgebras, such that the full algebra can be written as this tensor product of A, B, and C, and all of these subalgebras commute. And then what one can show in these papers here, that in fact, this algebraic structure induces a tensor product structure on the Hilbert space here. So this is the notion, this algebraic induced tensor product is the notion we're going to use to induce a physical notion of a physical tensor product structure. So, let's again start with a constrained system here. So here I have my physical state psi here, and it's acted on by some constraint here. And you know, you could think of this as a Hamiltonian constraint where all of these CA, CB, and CCs are the Hamiltonians associated with each A, B, and C here. What we can do then is again define a set of orientations of the frame A. So we can define things that are analogous to the clock states. So here again, we have some CA, it generates some unitary evolution. We can define the coherent states associated with the CA here. And then what we can do is we can define the conditional state of BC relative to A in the same way as we define the Page-Wooters conditional state, by taking a physical state here and looking at the overlap with this this state, this orientation state G here of reference frame A. And so what this is going to give us is a description of BC relative to A or from the perspective of A. And it turns out that this map here is invertible, right? So we can go from this state here back to a physical state. On the physical Hilbert space. So this is the setup. And now what we supposed was that, let's suppose that relative to A, the system BC does emit a tensor product decomposition. Maybe this is algebraically induced from the perspective of A. But then what this suggests is that we consider this tensor product decomposition of the algebra of observables here, just namely the bounded observables on each factor of the subgroup space. And then using those maps I just introduced on the previous slide, what we can do is basically lift these algebras that are now defined relative to the perspective of A and lift them to the physical Hilbert space. And that's what's being done here. And these are, what are these? These are basically just the algebra of relational Dirac observables of I, where I is either B or C, relative to A. So we get these relational Dirac observables. So what we have is we have, in the perspective of A, is we have this tensor product structure. And I've shown how we can construct these algebras on the physical Hilbert space associated with B relative to A and C relative to A. And you can show that these are actually commuting algebras, and that their tensor product is dense in the physical Hilbert space. And so what this means is that these commuting algebras, they form a tensor product structure on the physical Hilbert space. So in this way, we've introduced a physical notion of tensor product, one that's consistent with the constraints or gauge invariant, and is reference frame dependent. It depends on our choice of reference frame A. So this was the big idea behind the paper here. We proved two theorems. The first is basically saying different frames induce different partitions of the physical Hilbert space, and that the algebra of C relative to A might be different than the algebra of C relative to B. And the second theorem is we answered the question, when does the physical Hilbert space inherit that kinematical tensor product structure I discussed earlier? So that's the main story here, was getting this physical tensor product structure. So with that, I think just in the interest of time, I'm going to skip the part about the field theory, but I'm happy to return to that in the question section. And just I'll flash through this here and leave with my summary. So I began with discussing, giving a quantum description of clocks in terms of covariant POVMs. And then I used those covariant POVMs to introduce this Page-Wooters formalism and discuss the criticisms of Kukash and how they can be overcome. And then finally, I discussed this gauge invariant reference frame dependent notion of subsystems or tensor product structures that we constructed in terms of this formalism. So with that, I'll end there, and I'll be happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So we have some time for questions. There is one by Charlie.
Hi, thanks for the very interesting talk. I guess I was just wondering a little about the field theory extension. Is the idea just to define like a Cauchy slice for every time or something? I'm just guessing based on this picture.
Yeah. So I'm glad the picture was suggestive. The basic idea, and you're giving me an excuse to finish my talk, so I will take that as well. But the basic idea here is that you can look at exactly what you said, is that we start with some action here for our field theory, and just how when I was showing you those two theories before, we can parameterize our theory in terms of a set of arbitrary coordinates, T and X, like you said, like you said. And for each instance of time, what are these objects? Well, they're basically embeddings R, the real line, into Minkowski space, defined in terms of these coordinate functions. And so the big idea we're exploring is, well, it's these embeddings now that we need to quantize and that are going to act like our clock state. And so, we're going to associate each bedding with a ket X. And you can think of these as like position eigenkets in some sense, right? Or they play the analogous role, but they characterize an entire hypersurface. And then you can again introduce a constrained formulation and you get a momentum that allows you to write down coherent states in a similar way. And just very quickly, you can define the conditional state in the same way and recover the Schwinger-Tomanaga equation, which is basically like a functional evolution, which is basically what I would consider to be the recovery of standard quantum field theory in a functional description. So that's kind of how it goes. So I realized that was pretty quick, but like you said, it's to, you know, try and quantize these embeddings now that we're using to define the field theory.
We have a question by Lucian.
Hi, just some basic questions. So two related remarks, and I just wonder if you have any comment on this. So one is, there's a sense, it seems on the face of it, although this may not be true on deeper reflection, that this this Paige Wouters approach puts space and time on a different footing. So that's sort of remark one. And then remark two is, so of course it's true that you can only actually verify correlations between variables that appear at the same time. But actually a stronger statement is true, which is that you can only verify correlations between quantities which appear at the same point in space and time, because you can't non-locally check, you know, compare quantities. They have to actually be, in some sense, sufficiently local that you can make that kind of comparison. And indeed, you see this right. In experiments when they do, for example, correlations. They have to use some electronics and bring the information along wires to some electronics box to actually do the comparison. And it seems to me those two sort of observations, or two comments at least, might even be related. So the bigger question is there a sort of an approach which is somehow analogous to the Paige Wouters framework, but which ends up with the sort of taking advantage of the fact that you can only correlate things at the same point in space-time, not just time?
Yeah. Okay. So I'm sympathetic to both of the points you raised. On the first one, this was that it appears to treat time and space on different footings. And I would agree and disagree at the same time. In one sense, it treats them on the same footing in the sense that we describe both time and, say, position in terms of the same mathematical objects, namely observables, right? Our POVMs on the kinematical Hilbert space or the physical Hilbert space. But then where does it treat them differently is when we start talking about dynamics. And there, you know, it's because I would say, you know, we're asking a very specific type of question. How does this system change relative to the clock? And so already by asking that question, there's some asymmetry in what the role time is doing, right? Like it's the thing we're using to track the dynamics or that we're conditioning on. So maybe in like formulating dynamics, you know, we are choosing a particular variable and then it is playing a special role, but it kind of comes after the initial construction of the theory in some sense. But I don't know if that's maybe the way I think about it. But the second point, comparison at the same point. So yeah, I fully agree with what you're saying there. And I guess, yeah, I mean, if you wanted to extend, you know, if Don Page's notion of wanting to just verify probabilities as a single instant of time, maybe that's the right thing to do. It's not clear how to extend that to sort of another condition that it would be localized in space as well. But somehow when we just talk about the, you know, the usual measurement theory of, say, a particle on a real line, we don't usually worry about, you know, if it's over here in our measuring apparatus, it's just kind of, it gets to interact with it anyway. So I would say that we can recover the usual measurement theory, but maybe that would be, you know, that would be something to desire in a more general form where that might be the case. So yeah, I don't know. Or maybe, yeah.
Yeah, thanks. That's really interesting.
Erickson?
Hi, Alex. Thanks for a very exciting talk. So I just have a stupid question because I don't really know how how these things sit into a bigger picture, I guess. So for example, the Hamiltonian constraint, right? The fact that GR is frozen in time, right, has to do with the fact that we think of the evolution as evolving Cauchy slices, but the whole space-time is just one block, right? It's just one block in the middle of nowhere, right? Mm-hmm. But have you thought of is there a way to kind of, like, for example, in this sort of situation where there is no dynamics by the Hamiltonian, right? But you embed them into a system with a large, within a larger setting, so that this block of frozen object becomes dynamical in a bigger system. For example, I can think of, like, say, some space-time, right? Three plus one dimension. Maybe for some reason I can embed this into a 3+2 dimensional space-time, so that the extra time direction evolve this block, and then now it's no longer a Hamiltonian constraint. It should have a own Schrodinger equation induced by this bigger one. Have you thought about something along these lines?
So I'm not sure about introducing another time of it. Maybe some people have done this, but you can certainly consider constrained systems that do have a background time, right? Like electrodynamics, for example. We have a Gauss constraint, but then there still is sort of a background time relative to which things can evolve. So you certainly can embed constrained systems in terms of ones that do have a preferred time, but I'm not too sure about the specific idea there that you're discussing.
I mean maybe the example for GR part is a little bit of an overkill, but even in quantum mechanics, right? For example, if I say the relational dynamics is in like a four-dimensional Hilbert space, right? Will there be an external time interpretation just by embedding it into larger dimensions? So it becomes like an open system. Like I make an artificial environment to make it into a non-relational thing.
Well, I mean, in some sense, we kind of do the opposite. We're enlarging the phase space to include the clock, and that allows us to now describe correlations between the system and the clock and give sort of a time neutral formulation of the theory. So, maybe you could play the kind of, or do the kind of things you're suggesting. I'm not exactly sure.
Okay. Thanks.
But yeah. Thanks, Ericsson.
So, Dean, you can ask your question.
Q. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Dean.
I'm feeling quite puzzled. I have several questions, but let me just ask one about the field theory. I guess the main idea is to quantize the coordinates.
Quantize the embeddings.
Quantize the embedding. So my main question is, what theory are you getting in the end? It's certainly not quantum gravity, if I understood correctly.
No. There's a fixed Minkowski background.
Yeah. Right. Then are you not getting the ordinary QFT on flat space-time?
Yeah, no. So, there's a whole history of this parameterized field theory starting with Kukash back in the 70s that I skimmed over there. And the idea there is to formulate your field theory on an extended phase space that includes now a phase space associated with different embeddings, right? What you would recover in the end, the Schwinger-Tominaga equation, is basically the evolution of or the change in the field if you were to vary that embedding sort of at any point. So you get a functional differential equation in the end. So that's the theory you recover, is basically how does this scalar field in Minkowski, how does it change when the embedding itself changes?
And that previous work is within a standard QFT.
The Schwinger-Tominaga equation, yes.
Yeah. So then for your work, what's the context? Is it also standard QFT or is it something?
Well, we formulate it in terms of this parameterized field theory, right? And are trying to carry out the same construction a la Page and Wooters to see if we can recover the standard quantum field theory in terms of the Schwinger-Tominaga equation. So that I consider that to be a result.
Then the question is, why are you doing this? If in the end you just get standard QFT.
Right. Well, okay.
Maybe let me ask more concretely, what is this quantizing embedding doing for you? I mean,
Right.
Well, it seems you bring in some new piece of ingredient into your study to standard QFT, but I'm trying to understand what is this novel piece.
So I just want to be clear, like this parameterized field theory has been around for like almost 50 years. So it's not, you know, so that part of formulating the field theory on an extended phase space is not the stuff we're doing. We're trying to build upon that theory. Okay. But why might you want to do this? Well, you might want to formulate your theory not in a fixed coordinate system, right? Maybe you would like to fix your coordinate system after quantization or something like that. So you don't want to say impose the canonical commutation relations on equal time slices, maybe, or something like that. So here's a formulation where now, you know, the objects that you usually take to be as parameters can now be treated as quantum mechanical objects, sort of analogous to the clock and system case that I introduced at the beginning of the talk. So, I mean, I think that's interesting in itself. Schwinger and Tomonaga's original motivation for formulating field theory in that way was to recover a manifestly covariant formulation of the field theory. So I think that's interesting as well. I'm not sure if this is answering your question, Ding. Maybe you're trying to get at something else. I'll also just sort of reiterate what Feynman said, is that this is yet another way to go about formulating the field theory. And within this formalism, there's all sorts of other questions we can ask, right? How to change between different quantum foliations? Can we imagine a superposition of foliations? These sorts of things. And so the hope is that within this language, we might be able to start exploring some of those questions.
Yeah, I guess there are other people that have questions. So. I'd like to discuss more, but
of course.
Yeah, then it's Rob's turn. Yeah,
thanks for that. Thanks, Alex. My question, I guess, is I have some misgivings about the Page-Wooters approach for sort of understanding time evolution as emerging from a timeless picture. And so I kind of want to tell you what I don't like about it and see if you have a response. But I can essentially articulate what I don't like about it already in a kind of classical theory. And what I'm about to tell you is kind of informed by Julian Barber's sort of perspective on things. So if I just imagine a Newtonian universe with a bunch of particles, then, you know, Barber points out that, you know, to say, for example, that a particle, you know, that's inertial will move in a straight line at a constant speed isn't operationally meaningful because, you know, straight line relative to what? Constant speed relative to what? You don't have access to absolute space and absolute time to verify whether it really is moving at a constant speed relative to absolute space. So what do? You go looking for some physical system in the universe that can sort of be the proxy to absolute space so that you can test the Newtonian prediction. And so if you find some localized system that you think is inertial, and let's say it's, I don't know, some, you know, objects moving around one another, and you say, okay, well, that's going to be my physical clock. And then I'm going to ask about this other system and ask, is it moving at a constant speed relative to this physical clock I've defined? Well, the problem is that to some approximation, yes, but nothing in the universe is really inertial. You know, everything's interacting. Everything's non-inertial. So if you do it precisely enough, you'll say, no, Newtonian predictions are not verified relative to this particular physical system as a clock. And if you take this logic far enough and you ask, well, what do I need to include in my clock to make sure that the Newtonian predictions are strictly satisfied? The answer is the whole universe. Well, you know, all you have to do at the end of the day is sort of look at the whole universe and maybe have snapshots of it with different configurations and say, is there some way of labeling all those configurations with times such that the overall evolution does satisfy Newton's laws? That's ultimately how you can kind of vindicate the Newtonian prediction without access to absolute space and time. And so, you know, ultimately it seems to me that, you know, the moral of the story is that any finite system cannot ultimately serve as the fundamental clock. It can't be a proxy for true time. And so in the quantum case, I don't think it can either.
Right. Okay, so, I mean, I think I found myself nodding along with everything you said. So I'm in agreement, I think, with that. So given that, then, I mean, what do I want to say is that I think it's an important task to tell the story of how you go about recovering the ideal time evolution with an ideal clock. I think this is what you're getting at. But then what I think is also important is to have a formulation that allows you to consider more general clocks. And I think it's interesting to ask, how would the dynamics look relative to these more general clocks? In what way would Newton's law be violated or something like this, right? In what you're saying. So I don't know if this is a criticism against the approach or just sort of like an observation, and I agree, and we should be using more realistic clocks. The other thing I will maybe say in reference to what you first said was that, you know, the observation that a particle moves in a straight line, that's not operationally meaningful unless there's other stuff, an inertial frame to compare it to. I agree with this. I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought.
But maybe I could ask a question about your response. Yeah. But I mean, I agree that there's sort of value in you know, like for example, just in Newtonian mechanics, we can certainly sort of say, well, are the Newtonian predictions for this stuff obeyed when I take my clock to be some physical system out there that's almost inertial, and I can sort of test it that way. And that's, you know, fine. And if your measurements are not too precise, you'll see that you're within error. And it's only when you get much more precise and suddenly the non-inertialness of your reference system becomes apparent that there's going to be any problem. Mm-hmm. And so I agree with all that, but to some extent, the point is that we would never take any of those finite subsystems to be the definition of time in Newtonian mechanics. And so what troubles me a bit about the Page-Woodruff formalism is it seems to me it's trying to say something more than, here's a practical way of maybe testing out the validity of quantum theory, you know, relative to some physical clock. It's trying to say, oh, no, this is actually how we get a definition of time in a timeless quantum theory. And that's the thing that I'm saying, I don't think that can work.
I don't necessarily want to make that claim, right? I would just say that here in constrained dynamics, we're presented a problem where we have a Hamiltonian constraint, and there we are forced to tell a story about how we get time evolution out of that. And I think we can tell a convincing story a la the Page-Woodruff formalism. So I think more that's the problem it's trying to solve. I don't know if that puts a different spin on it. In some sense, like we you know, when we quantize GR, we end up with a system that Hamiltonian is equal to zero. So what do we do with that? We need to do something. We need to get evolution out. And so I would say maybe the Page and Wooters is one way to go about doing that. I did remember the other point I wanted to make about that I lost my train of thought on was that you had made this remark about it's not operationally significant for the particle to go in a straight line or to verify this statement of Newton's laws operationally. And I think that does have a role to play in here in the construction of those relational Dirac observables, in the sense that, you know, I mentioned this notion of partial observables on, say, maybe the clock in the system. And then what is the complete or the relational observables are these G12 ones. And somehow those are really the only things that we can verify or measure in the theory. That's kind of what's coming out. And I think that's consistent with what you're saying, your critique. So that's the notion or the terminology for these partial and complete observables, I think is that remark that you made there. Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, no, thanks for the comment.
Andrea?
Hi, thanks, Philippe. Hey, thanks, Alex. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks for the talk. So this question is related to this idea of the clip that you shared by Feynman of having different ways of thinking about the same experimental results, different explanations. And here we have the case in quantum mechanics where we have several interpretations of the experimental facts, the different interpretations of quantum mechanics. And my question would be, do you think that this approach that you're following in Page-Woodruff is closer to one of these interpretations? It looks to me that it's closer to the many-word interpretation with this fixed wave function, maybe. But I don't want to get it wrong, and I'm wondering if other interpretations are compatible with it?
I think that's a good point or a good question. And so I would agree. Yeah, it's closest to an Avredian interpretation. And even in the original writings of Page and Wooters, they refer to that conditional state as the Avredian state or the relative state. But I did kind of allude to it in my talk, is that I think there's one significant difference with an Avredian interpretation. And I'm not an expert, so feel free if there are people in the audience to correct me. But there, what one supposes is you have this universal wave function that just evolves unitarily and that's it. And then you spend a lot of time thinking about how you get probabilities out. Here, the situation's a little different, is that, and I made this point, is that we can just, from the Born rule and probabilities, we can get out this notion of unitary evolution, right? So I think there is a distinction between this Avredian interpretation. Like, you might ask, you know, like, with which time is the universal wave function evolving relative to? So that doesn't really arise here. But then again, also, you know, because you brought up the multiple ways to think about the same theory, this reminds me of an essay by Rob Speckens, where he basically argued that as a convention with how we break up our theories into, and I'm paraphrasing, please interject, but that it was a convention of how we partition our theories into kinematics and dynamics. And so you might consider this Page Wooters as one convention where everything is sort of in the kinematics or the measurement theory. And maybe the many worlds or the Avredian is something where the choice is all in the dynamics or the unitary evolution. So I'm not sure if that answers your question. I think certainly the closest.
Yeah, that goes.
But I think there's some work that has
to be done. Yeah, that goes a certain way. Because when you do the Born rule, you never update the wave function though, right? You just use that second formula you showed us after Kuchar's objection, but you don't actually replace the wave function with something new. It's always within working with the same wave function.
Right. So that physical, you never have to talk about the collapse of this big physical wave function,
right. But
you might want to tell the story of how it looks like that conditional state collapses when different measurements happen or something like this. And I don't know if that story has been worked out. So I think that might be.
Yeah, but it's interesting that you make progress by modifying one of the interpretations. You make progress in one of the problems in quantum gravity, and you know you leave behind other interpretations. So that's.
Oh, and I should say there was a whole other interpretation, the Montevideo interpretation by Gambini,
Montevideo,
and Porto. Montevideo, yes. That you know, was really inspired on these conditional probabilities. So that would be the closest one because it was built on this. So that would be another place to look. I should
look into it. Okay, thanks.
Okay, so I raised my hand because I can give myself a question. I have a question about your solution of this problem of like two time probabilities with that you discussed. And what I'm wondering is about the relationship between the rule for the two time probabilities and the one for the single time probabilities.
Mm-hmm.
So it would seem that, you know, that the single time probabilities are independent of what happens elsewhere, while the marginal of the two time probabilities will not be. So what is it that the single time probabilities are wrong? Like you shouldn't be looking at those if you're trying to describe an experiment where they were.
Did you say? I think I missed the crux. You said
the idea is that right, you're reproducing quantum probabilities,
mm-hmm.
and if there's a quantum system prepared in some state, and then some measurement, and then a second measurement. The marginal probabilities, the single time probabilities at the second time of the second mm-hmm. measurement depend on the choice of basis for the first measurement,
mm-hmm.
right? And
mm-hmm.
since you recover quantum mechanics, your probability rule has this feature,
mm-hmm.
but the marginal probabilities that, well, not the marginal probabilities, but the single time probability rule, the original one, doesn't have this feature. Because it doesn't refer to what's happening at other times. So what is the I mean, how do you think about this issue?
Well, I think of them asking like sort of two different questions. Like they correspond to two different events or situations in some sense. So it's one thing to ask about what's the system doing when the clock reads the time t, and then it's another question, you know, what is the system doing at t2 conditioned on some other proposition of the system doing a at t1. So I would say that maybe in general they're looking at different scenarios and corresponding to, they're computing different things in some sense.
Okay, so it's kind of an admission that the sort of wave function of the universe, this psi, you know, timeless wave function of the universe, is not complete in the sense that you need to specify this other thing, that like the prop, in a sense, the property you care about, in order to know its properties.
Well, okay, I wouldn't say that psi is incomplete. I mean, that's maybe a loaded word, I guess, but I don't.
Yeah, maybe. Okay, sorry.
but that you can calculate different probability distributions from it. I would maybe say it like that. Or maybe I'm missing exactly.
Yeah, maybe I'm not able to say exactly what I want to say. I feel like, let's say for me, I'm drawn to this, time solipsism as kind of, you're forced to do this when you're doing the page wooters, and mm-hmm. I'm trying to, because of this unrelatedness of the two time probabilities, which are in some sense non-measurable by anybody, with the single time probabilities, which are the ones that presumably you have access to. But I'm not really.
I guess what I'm saying is you can get those other two time ones in terms of the one time ones by introducing these memories.
I agree. It works. Yeah. But okay. No, I mean, maybe it's.
We can talk more
for a different for a longer conversation. Let's take like a last question by Aldo.
Hi. Thank you. Thank you for a very nice talk. I had a question about imperfect clocks. So how do you think of them? Or like clocks whose like Hamiltonian somehow spreads the wave packet in some sense, and then there are extra effects that happen. And it may be a not related, I don't know how related question / comment. In the case, how important is to have these like the clock to be decoupled from the rest of the system. So this, I think, is pretty much what happens when you have a parameterized system. You automatically get one of these perfect and decoupled clock.
Yes.
And GR is kind of the prototypical example where probably neither of them happens. And I think that goes also in the direction of relates to Rob's comment as well, where in that case, somehow everything is so entangled in together that you don't have, the problem is extracting a decent enough clock that doesn't need to be perfect because there's no external Newtonian time to be referring to, but just regular enough to be usable in certain.
It's great. So your question is like, what is a non-ideal clock? And I think there's sort of three ways that it can be non-ideal. The first is, I introduced these covariant positive operator value measures in terms of these clock states. And those clock states, they were a one-dimensional projector, right? But I could take some convolution of that one-dimensional projector, maybe just write it as an integral over some Gaussian with some width that encodes my certainty or uncertainty about actually what time I'm measuring. So you can do this. And in this way, I would say, well, this isn't an ideal clock anymore because it's not a one-dimensional projector. What happens in that case, this was the work of Gambini, Porto, and Poulin, is they basically asked what happens when you have some epistemic uncertainty in the clock. You get a Lindblad equation that comes out that describes some sort of decoherence. So they were able to show that that comes out. The other way a clock might not be ideal is that covariant relation I introduced to you, that the different clock states are connected by the clock Hamiltonian, right? That might not hold anymore. And so there's some work done by Misha Woods and Max Locke that looked into non-ideal clocks in that way. And I believe there's a recent paper out that looked at that non-ideality and again showed that that resulted in some kind of decoherence.
You mean some interaction Hamiltonian between the different, No.
So you're right. Usually we think I'll get to the interaction in one sec.
Okay. But
usually we think of decoherence coming from some interaction with some environment. We trace up these degrees of freedom and we're losing information, blah, blah, blah. But we can also, the way it comes up here is that, you know, we're making some imprecise measurement of our clock.
Okay. I understood the first kind where you have you don't have a projective operator on a single state, but what's the second one? Can you repeat it again?
So confused. I introduced these covariant clock states, right? That the clock states are connected to one another by the unitary generator.
Yes, I see what you said. The group structure that there is on that. Okay.
Yeah. So you can ask what happens when you relax that. And there, I believe you get another decoherence that pops up. And then the final thing was what happens when you have interactions. And I agree that this is a very important thing. So I can just show you what happens when you do interactions. So maybe you have a Hamiltonian constraint that looks something like this here, and now you have some interaction term. And like you say, with gravity, you can never shield such interactions, right? So then again, you can define your clock states in a similar way in terms of these covariant states, define your conditional state. And now because of this interaction, you still get the Schrodinger equation here, but now you get some modification to the Schrodinger equation. And this is a time non-local integral operator. This is integrating over all of the times in this integration kernel depends on the specific type of interaction. And so if you were to look at, say, just Newtonian gravity, something like this, what happens is you find that the conditional state in the Page-Wooters formalism satisfies the Schrodinger equation again, but it now picks up some correction to it. So you do get a modified Schrodinger equation, but you can still talk about an evolution.
Thank you. Yeah.
Okay, then I think we should end this here and thank Alex again for the great talk.